Hi there, Stacy here again, welcoming you back for the May edition of Angus Talking Newspaper. I hope you're having a lovely spring and early summer as we're enjoying longer days and warmer weather. On this month's edition, we have Julie reading from the 23rd of April, Leslie from the 30th of April, and Gwen reading from the 7th of May. We close out with a TNF sounding about the importance of updating your password and some basic cybersecurity insight. If you're listening via USB, we've also added in a short story where visually impaired military veteran Kathy helps solve a mystery on the Norfolk Broads. As always, thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy.
Hello, this is Julie reading from the Angus County Press from Thursday, April 23rd. Sewage concerns in Broughty Ferry. Sewage debate in Broughty Ferry by Mark Dowie. Campaigners and water users in Scotland are calling for urgent action on the sewage crisis ahead of the upcoming Holyrood elections. Campaign group Surfers Against Sewage, SAS, is urging candidates to keep the toxic pollution of the country's wild waters at the top of the election agenda and is taking the message on the road. SAS is taking the sewage debate to water sports hotspots, with election candidates invited to answer questions from locals at a series of hustings events. The campaign group is calling for urgent government action to reveal the truth about the true extent of the Scottish sewage scandal. In 2024, sewage was dumped in Scottish waters over 23,000 times, but these figures are from just 6.7% of the network. SAS says the true figures are likely to be much higher. Henry Swithenbank, SAS Senior Policy and Advocacy Manager, said decades of government inaction mean that Scottish waters are being polluted by sewage, plastic waste and the toxic chemicals they carry. A perfect storm that's making water users sick and choking our most cherished wild places. Water users in Scotland are totally in the dark when it comes to water quality. Only a third of the network is monitored, and this lack of transparency is putting swimmers, surfers and water users in Scotland at risk. HMO decision is put on hold. A decision on a controversial plan to convert a former Forfar care home into a house of multiple occupation, HMO, has been put on hold. Ayrshire-based Veriton Group wants to turn Lochbank Manor into a 38-bed HMO. But the plans for the empty two-storey building, which ceased operating as a care home 2 years ago, have attracted considerable opposition, with more than 600 objections lodged with Angus Council. Councillors were due to make a decision on the plans at the Development Standards Committee this week, with planners having recommended approval of the project subject to conditions. However, members of the committee decided a site visit would be appropriate before making up their minds. Questions have been raised locally over whether the accommodation could be used for asylum seekers, but those suggestions have been strenuously denied by the applicant, who told this week's meeting that the intention was to partner with charities in a landlord arrangement. Concerns were raised about the lack of kitchen space by Councillor Bill Duff, who suggested just three kitchens for 38 rooms was woefully inadequate, and Councillor Linda Clark called for a site visit so that members were properly informed and could ask relevant questions of planning officer before making their decision. The committee agreed this would be the most appropriate course of action. Fatal accident inquiry into kennel owner's death by Mark Dowie. A fatal accident inquiry is to be opened into the death of Angus kennel owner Adam Watts. The Crown Office and Procurator Fiscal Service has lodged a first notice to begin the court process. Mr. Watts, 55, the owner and operator of Juniper Kennels and Cattery at Auchter House, died on December 22, 2021 after being attacked by a dog. A preliminary hearing is set for June 8th at Forfar Sheriff Court. Memis and Fearn's April WRI meeting news update. Memis and Fearn WRI's April meeting was all about flowers. Visitor Patsy Payton delighted members with a demonstration of six beautiful flower arrangements, each showing different styles, colours and techniques. She explained how simple materials can be used to create striking displays suitable for both everyday decoration and special occasions. Members enjoyed watching the arrangements come together and picked up several useful hints and tips along the way. Meanwhile, Sandra Both provided an entertaining quiz with all the questions centred around flowers and gardening knowledge. The quiz created plenty of discussion and laughter as members compared answers and shared their own gardening experiences. Patsy and Sandra also judged the evening's competitions in the fruity coleslaw section. First place was awarded to Lavina Harvey, second place to Davina Farquharson, and third place to Rosemary McKenzie, with all entries praised for their flavour and presentation. In the Flower of the Month competition, Kathleen Melville took first place, followed by Davina Farquharson in second place and Sue Penny in third. Members were reminded that there will be a whist evening on Friday, May the 1st, at Memis and the Glens Hall, starting at 7 p.m. Entry is £6, which includes supper, and everyone is warmly welcome to attend for what promises to be an enjoyable social evening. 1,398 meals donated by Mark Dowie. Aldi helped to deliver 1,398 meals to people in need across Angus over the Easter period by donating surplus food from stores across the UK. The donations helped to support families that might otherwise struggle with the extra cost of Easter celebrations and feeding children during the school break. Working with local charities and community groups through its long-standing partnership with Neighbourly, the discounter redistributes fresh and chilled food from its stores to those who need it most, with donations made over Easter helping to make sure all families could come together to enjoy festivities, regardless of financial circumstances. This forms part of Aldi's nationwide food donation programme, which pairs every UK store with a local charity or community group to ensure surplus food is put to good use all year round. More than 711,500 meals were donated throughout the UK over the recent school holidays, with 10 groups in Angus benefiting from the initiative. The latest figures build on Aldi's long-term partnership with Neighbourly, which has enabled the delivery of the equivalent of more than 50 million meals since 2019. Appeal after A932 crash. Officers are appealing for information after an 89-year-old man died in a crash on the A932 near Forfar. The incident involving a blue Audi Q4 happened at around 9:30 p.m. on Wednesday, April 15th, near the town's golf club. The driver was pronounced dead at the scene. The road was closed to allow an investigation to be carried out and reopened around 6:15 a.m. the following morning. Sergeant John McDermott asked anyone with information to get in touch. He said, "Our thoughts are with the family and friends of the man who has died. Inquiries are ongoing and we're appealing to anyone who witnessed the crash who has not yet spoken to officers to contact us. We'd also ask anyone with dash cam footage to come forward. Anyone with information about the incident is asked to contact Police Scotland on the non-emergency number 101, quoting incident 3381 of Wednesday, April 15th date. First Minister drops in to visit Community Trust. Montrose Community Trust on Saturday welcomed First Minister John Swinney to Lynx Park Stadium for a showcase of its impactful work in health, employability, climate and community. From its beginnings as a football-focused initiative, the Trust has gone through a remarkable period of growth to become one of the North East's most impactful charities, now delivering more than 35 programmes that reach every corner of the local community. The Trust's £2 million Gable End development was a key highlight of the visit, as CEO Chris Platt gave the First Minister an overview of the facility, which has raised £800,000 in funding to date and will begin construction in September. The building will house a nationally leading dementia centre, which will act as the new base for the Montrose Connections meeting group, which was visited more than 1,500 times in the past year by those suffering from dementia and their family carers. The Gable End will also encompass a community hub, a digital lab and a new office for the MCT staff, who currently work from a small windowless space within the main stand at Lynx Park. Focusing on community-led preventative approaches to issues such as social isolation and integration, physical and mental health and employment, the Trust brings together local people from all walks of life and is led by a team of 19 permanent members of staff who are supported by a 120-strong group of local volunteers. Freakham Hub has closed. There was a shock locally as the Freecom Hub has closed with immediate effect due to a lack of financial funding, writes freelance Wallace Ferrier. The news appeared on social media, which has been widely spread locally. The hub at Freecom opened in January 2019 and was a fabulous asset to the community. The hub held classes in dance, keep fit, singing classes, and had multi-function rooms available to rent. And downstairs was a cafe with hot and cold food. The hub is now in the hands of third-party agents. A spokesperson said they had a couple of pre-booked funeral wakes which they were committed to, but would be doing their own catering now. Historic Glam's house sold. The lease for a historic house and venue near Glam's has changed hands. Glam's house, a historic Georgian guest house and a landmark property near the village, is located in the 14.5-acre Strathmore estate, close to Glam's castle. The property contains 7 bedrooms, a well-equipped kitchen diner, a lounge, and a separate dining room and flexible basement space for functions and gatherings. The house is set within large landscaped gardens and has a private car park and operates for exclusive hire and events. The lease was put up for sale via specialist business property advisor Christian Cole and has been acquired by Richard Mayers, who owns Balmure Field House, a wedding and experience venue near Dundee. Mr. Mayer said, "We're thrilled to be managing this beautiful mansion which shares so much history with the castle. We're already attracting visitors from Scotland and across the globe who are looking for luxury vacation rentals or weddings. We have great plans to make Glam's House a beacon for tourists holidaying across Angus." Arbroath is on the map for Pudsey's Challenge by Paul McCabe. BBC Children in Need's famous mascot Pudsey Bear is coming to Arbroath as he makes a 2,200 nautical mile journey around the UK coastline in a J160 yacht. Between May and August, Pudsey will team up with Jonathan Bruin and the crew of Big Bear to visit around 35 coastal communities. Along the way, they will raise funds and awareness for BBC Children in Need, with a particular focus on children's mental health for 2026, as they aim to arrive in Arbroath sometime between July 5th to the 7th. This is the first time Pudsey has embarked on a round Britain voyage, visiting all countries of the UK, England, Wales, Northern Ireland and Scotland. And throughout the voyage, the crew, many of whom are lifelong friends, will host community events and meet local supporters. They hope to host inclusive walks and community events, engage with schools and local groups, raise awareness of children's mental health, all whilst generating vital fundraising support. The Big Bear Voyage 2026 is driven by a simple belief: every child deserves to feel safe, supported and able to thrive, and the aim is to raise £70,000. Care provider scores top mark. Rossi Young People's Trust near Montrose has been commended in 2 national inspections for the quality of its care. With a history spanning over 160 years, Rossi provides bespoke education, specialist support and welfare services for children and young people with complex needs up to age 18. Set amongst 150 acres of mature grounds and woodlands, it offers both residential and secure accommodation, supported by almost 200 highly skilled staff. The secure service, inspected by the Care Inspectorate in February 2026, received a 5, which is a very good rating, and the residential non-secure service received a 6, excellent rating in November 2025. Inspectors spent 5 days at Rossi's secure unit, which accommodates up to 26 young people, typically referred through the children's hearing or court systems. The service across 5 recently upgraded houses also includes a purpose-built education facility, indoor and outdoor fitness spaces, and a forest school offering young people opportunities to learn and develop skills in an outdoor environment. Inspection findings highlighted nurturing care and rich, meaningful experiences. Inspectors noted health needs were well understood and met promptly, and praised the leadership team for their strong value base and forward-thinking, progressive approach. The service was rated highly for supporting children's rights and well-being, with inspectors stating children and young people are safe, feel loved and get the most out of life. Makers Markets Return. More than 40 artists and makers from across Angus will show their work at art markets and open studios this May during the 5th Angus Festival of Makers. The event, organised by Angus Creatives, runs from the 1st to the 31st May to showcase the county's creative community. The festival opens on the weekend of 1st to 4th May with four art markets featuring the work of 25 artists and makers exhibiting in local clusters at Monifieth, Forfar, Kirriemuir and Brechin and Montrose. The art markets are a chance for visitors to talk to artists, learn more about their practice and to buy artwork and creative pieces direct. There will be a fifth art market over the weekend of 29 to 31st May, with 15 contributors in a variety of disciplines from ceramics and printmaking to stained glass and photography. Visitors of all ages are invited to the festival. Admission is free and most venues are fully accessible. Angus Castle for Sale with Property Portfolio by Mark Dowie. A castle near Forfar has been put up for sale as part of a portfolio of luxury venues in Angus and Fife, with an asking price of £15 million. Specialist business property adviser Christie & Co. has been instructed to sell the Kinnettles portfolio, comprising Kinnettles Castle and Kinnettles Mansion and Kinnettles Hotel, Bar and Restaurant, both in St Andrews. Set within grounds of 58 acres, Kinnettles Castle operates as a destination wedding and event venue. The castle features 11 bedrooms and suites, a selection of impressive public rooms, a bar and lounge and a grand entrance. A converted coach house adds a further 8 bedrooms and benefits from private parking, a hot tub and an outdoor barbecue area. The grounds comprise 44 acres of lawns and gardens, as well as 14 acres of woodland, with scenic locations ideal for photography, strengthening the estate's appeal as an exclusive wedding and events venue. A permanent marquee connected to the castle and with capacity for 140 seated guests is included. The property also features an impressive in-and-out driveway and a two-bedroom gate lodge. Bus Electrification Scheme Goes Live by Mark Dowie. Preparations for the transition of Stagecoach's vehicles to an electric fleet have taken a step forward. Aurora Utilities, the independent distribution network operator, has connected EV charging at East Scotland's Stagecoach depots in what is a nationwide push by the company towards zero carbon. It is helping to accelerate Stagecoach Group's zero carbon transition in local communities in Angus, Tayside and Fife. Sites now live in Scotland include Arbroath, Ardrossan, Dundee, Kilmarnock and St Andrews. Aurora's expanded network upgrades will enable capacity for around 1,330 new electric buses, representing more than 16% of Stagecoach's total UK fleet, and marking a major step forward in the operator's electrification plans. Hospital Field takes the top prize for its gardens by John A. McInnes. Hospital Field is delighted to announce they have been awarded the 34th edition of the International Carlo Scarpa Prize for Gardens 2026. This coincides with a horticulture programme that includes the culmination of a two-year residency with Rebecca Chesney, the 2026 edition of annual Grow Up Summer Camp, and the homecoming of Hospital Field's award-winning garden shown at the Chelsea Flower Show to an Arbroath school. Awarded by an international committee brought together by the Benetton Study Centre for Landscape in Treviso, Italy, the prize combines the production of a 60-minute documentary film and the publication of a significant book on the work of Hospital Field. The prize also shows Hospital Field alongside an astonishing selection of other sites around the world that are caring for and considerate of landscape. This is the first time a garden in Scotland has been awarded this prize. Hospital Field Director Lucy Byatt said, "This is so exciting to receive such a significant international prize. We have invested in substantial change at Hospital Field as we rethink the model." Bound into his vision for Hospital Field, the artist, Patrick Allen Fraser, recognised that creating a space for artists and the development of their work was urgent. "We know this idea is as vital now as it ever was." Mixed weekend in pre-season for Arbroath United. Arbroath United v Dundee High School FPs at Loughlin's on Saturday, April the 18th. Arbroath United won by 3 wickets. And we have Max at the double in Roselee defeat by Paul McCabe. Montrose Roselee went down to a narrow 2-1 defeat to Dundee St James in the Midlands First Division. Goals from McLaughlin and McCleary, either side of one from Roselee's Calder, sealed the points for the visitors. And we've got Lichtys lose out in semi-final by Paul McCabe. Arbroath Ladies were well beaten in their Scottish Power Regional League Cup semi-final against Bishopton. It was an afternoon to forget for the Red Lichtys, as they were thumped 5-1 by the Central West League side. Hannah Coyle's opener for Bishopton was cancelled out by forward Claire Henry, but Bishopton stuck 3 times in less than 5 minutes through Hannah Scott, Katrina McAllister, then Samantha Davis, before half-time to give Arbroath a mountain to climb in the second half. And Owen heads to Florida for biggest fight of his career. An amateur 4-4 fighter is preparing for the biggest bout of his career after landing a place on a fight card in the US. Owen Morris, 20, will compete in a boxing bout at the Island Fights 9-6 event at the Pensacola Bay Centre in Florida on May 1st. He will take on Jay Hooks in the contest. It marks a rapid rise for the young fighter, who only began training during COVID restrictions and now competes across multiple combat disciplines. The former Forfar Academy pupil said the opportunity came about during a visit to his grandmother in Florida, where he was introduced to a local gym. "My gran stays in Pensacola, Florida, where the fight is happening. We went over for a 2-week holiday and I trained at a local gym called Witness Martial Arts. The owner let me train for free and I got sparring in with a UFC fighter who trains there. After that, I came back to Scotland, saw there was a fight card on while we were going back over on holiday, and I thought, why not? It took me about a week or so to get hold of the promotion. Then I got in touch with the matchmaker and we managed to sort something out." He said, "I've always watched the UFC and all the fighting throughout my life, but I first properly got into it during lockdown. I got a punch bag and started training myself and watching fights. I trained on my own for about a year, maybe a year and a half. Then eventually I got the courage to go down to kickboxing. I've not stopped since." Waddle to leave Montrose. Kerr Waddle will leave Montrose at the end of the season after 7 years. Waddle joined the Gable Endies in 2019 from Dundee and has made 109 appearances for Stuart Petrie's side, scoring 8 times, the last of which being a vital winner against Inverness Caledonian Thistle at home back in December. Known for his physicality, aerial strength and calmness in possession, Kerr has played an important role in some of the team's most competitive campaigns in recent years, making a strong contribution to the club's progress in League One. Waddle expressed his appreciation to the club and supporters, adding, I've really enjoyed my time at Montrose. It's a brilliant club with brilliant people, and I'm grateful for the support I've had from the fans, the staff and my teammates. I wish the club every success going forward." A club spokesman said, "Everyone at Montrose FC thanks Kerr for his contribution on and off the pitch and wishes him the very best for the future."
Hello, this is Leslie reading from Angus County Press for the newspaper Thursday, 30th of April. And the front page is a lovely picture here of a royal visit to Montrose Community Centre, and it's the Earl of Forfar, or otherwise the Duke of Edinburgh. The title is Royal Approval for Trust's Work. Montrose Community Trust, MCT, welcomed a royal guest this week when His Royal Highness the Earl of Forfar visited to find out about its work in the community. It was a milestone occasion for the charity, which championed its work in youth development, health and well-being and employment in the local community. His Royal Highness was greeted by MCT CEO Chris Platt at Lynx Park Stadium, where he found out about its youth development programmes, a cause closely associated with His Highness's through his long-standing support for young people. During the visit, the Duke met participants in the Trust Sports Employability Programme. The programme provides young people with pathways into employment, further education and apprenticeships in sports and other industries. Through SPE, the Trust uses its position as a community connector, arranging work placements, job shadowing, mentorship opportunities within local organisations for 16 to 25-year-olds. The Trust highlighted other initiatives, including its community garden, which regularly hosts local school pupils for sessions encouraging outdoor learning and environmental awareness. A wide range of volunteer roles across its programmes also provides opportunities for young people to develop and work together with adults. This approach allows different generations to learn from one another and builds young people's self-belief and social skills. The Trust, which saw more than 22,000 engagements in 2024-5, is committed to providing opportunities for young people, with 60% of its operational team under 25 or have progressed through employment programmes. It's also aided by a team of youth volunteers. Acknowledging that health and fitness are key strands of the Duke's work, at the pitch site, he watched Montrose Academy pupils participate in one of its regular football sessions. As well as promoting physical activity, these sessions build social skills, teamwork and resilience, highlighting MCT's role in providing safe environments for children to develop vital skills while supporting grassroots football. The Duke was also shown plans for the Gable End project, a purpose-built development to revitalise the football ground's main entrance, including a nationally leading dementia centre, community hub and a new base for the Trust staff. New owners for Care Home. Residential care home in Arbroath has new owners. Keen Premier Group, a Glasgow-based independent care provider, has completed the acquisition of Priority Care Group. The deal will double the size of its portfolio and significantly extend its reach across Scotland. The transaction brings six established care homes into the Keen family, adding 233 beds and a highly experienced operational team. It also includes the St. Vigand home in Arbroath. Yoga studio approved. Plans for the redevelopment of Montrose's historic rope works have been approved by councillors. The plans, lodged by local firm Fraser Commercial Group, will see the C-listed building on Bent's Road transformed into a yoga studio, hair salon and storage units. The approved development is a sealed version of a scheme which also includes a bakery and cafe. Angus Council Development Standards Committee approved the fresh plans at a recent meeting. The studio will operate Monday to Saturday from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m, hosting two or three classes daily with up to 15 participants in each class. The storage facilities will be unstaffed and accessible from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Plans to redevelop the first site first emerge in 2024, including the proposal for the bakery and the cafe. However, the application was later withdrawn. But councillors delayed a decision on the application in order to visit the site. They also asked planning officials to deliver a detailed transport plan outlining how access and parking issues in the narrow street would be addressed. But now the plans have been unanimously approved. Bid to find way to save a valued hub. Urgent talks are being sought with Angus Council by local politicians following the closure of the Freecombe Community Hub. The Board of Trustees at Freecombe Community Hub Limited announced on April the 16th that they will be ceasing operations with immediate effect. The Freecombe Community Hub opened in 2019 following a 10-year campaign by local residents and provided a range of facilities and classes alongside a cafe. Stephen Geffins, MP for Arbroath and Broughty Ferry, and SNP Councillor Lloyd Melville have written a joint letter to the Chief Executive of Angus Council, seeking an urgent meeting to discuss the closure. They expressed their concerns for the workforce and volunteers, and are looking to find out what measures the council is considering to support the community hub. The Board of Trustees confirmed the closure in a statement saying that they had taken the difficult decision to seek to close the charity as it was no longer able to meet its financial obligations or continue trading. Trustees said, despite sustained efforts to secure additional funding, reduce operational costs and explore all viable alternatives, the charity has reached a position where continued operation is not financially sustainable. As a result, all services have now ceased. The Board of Trustees deeply regrets this outcome. This decision has been made only after exhausting all reasonable options to maintain operations. Vintage Lorry was popular with lovers of Tunnocks products. A promotional Vintage Lorry appeared at Morrison's supermarket in Arbroath last Thursday, April 23rd. The well-known Uddingston-based biscuit company, perhaps most famous for its iconic tea cakes, caramel wafers and caramel logs, owns the lorry. And they had a free sample stall within the supermarket. The lorry is a fleur-de-lis, vintage 1930s style, but it was actually constructed 48 years ago as a promotional vehicle for the Tunnocks Biscuit Company. The vehicle drew quite a crowd, with many customers getting their phones out to snap a photo of the lorry. Driving the vintage vehicle and running the free sample store was David Brown, who added the vintage lorry, said the vintage lorry was a fun drive, but only reached about 50 miles an hour. Family-run Tunnocks has been in business since 1890, when it was established by Thomas Tunnock. And the picture is absolutely great. The vehicle's got logos and signs all over it for the Tunnocks biscuits. It's bright red, and it's got big rails and huge lights on the front, and it just looks really very eye-catching. Safe space for siblings. A new space designed to strengthen relationships between brothers and sisters in care has opened its doors in Angus. Cooney House is in the grounds of Rossi Young People's Trust near Montrose and provides a safe, welcoming and child-centred environment where siblings separated by the care system can come together, spend time and build lasting connections. Purpose-built lodge and outdoor play area were opened by former residents Razia McClusker and Caitlin Greaves, who lived at Rossi as teenagers. Cooney House is now welcoming children and young people from across Scotland. Initial inquiries can be made by anyone involved in the young person's life, including family members, social workers and young people themselves. The new space builds on the sector-leading work of Rossi Young People's Trust, a charity with more than 160 years' experience supporting young people with complex needs. The project has been funded by a £250,000 grant from Curra Foundation through the Promise Partnership, alongside additional investment from Rossi Young People's Trust. Forfar Probus Club welcomed Christine Donaldson of Strathmore Woolen Company to their meeting last week. Christine, who's worked within the Scottish textile industry for over 30 years, has been the proprietor of Strathmore Woolen Company Limited in Forfar since taking over ownership of the company in 2018. She is the only full-time member of the workforce of nine in the company premises, which is in Forfar's North Street. Christine outlined the previous history of the company, which was originally founded in 1949 as a joint venture between Don Brothers Boost and company in Forfar and Ballantines of Peeble, and demonstrated her entrepreneurial skills and determination to continue its reputation for quality tartan products, combined with outstanding customer service, while bringing its market into the 21st century. She traced the origins of plans, kilts and tartan weaving through the ages, from the Falkirk twill 1,200 years ago to over 13,000 patterns now in the Scottish Register of Tartans, with some 50 new applications being submitted a week. Christine and her team of models were just back from Tartan Week in New York, displaying their latest designs. And they'd had a ball walking Fifth Avenue and supplying the Navy SEALs with a new tartan. Many questions were asked from the floor, and the audience showed their appreciation when thanks were proposed by Bob Kidd. And there's a picture of Christine there, and there's also a picture of the Forfar Academy tartan, which she brought along, which is a lovely smart grey jacket and a red and blue tartan kilt. Looks very smart and very bright. Tai Chi in Montrose. Tai Chi classes offer relaxed, friendly fitness. The Angus Tai Chi Academy has launched new beginners Tai Chi classes in Lawrence Kirk on Montrose this week. Lawrence Kirk classes started on Tuesday night at Mayence Fitness Lawrence Kirk Business Park, while the first of two beginners classes in Montrose were due to take place on April 29th. Another class starts on Thursday 7th of May in the Scott Jubilee Panmure Place Montrose. Tai Chi is an ancient Chinese art, a moving meditation practiced by millions of people over the centuries. Montrose residents may even have seen some of the academy members some Saturday mornings when the tide is suitable at the bottom of the wooden ramp on the beach. A spokesperson for the Angus Tai Chi Academy said, "If you see us there and would like to know more, do come and have a chat with us before or between sets. It's a gentle weight-bearing exercise, a sequence of slow, graceful movements that relax and strengthen both body and mind." Next item, return for guest. On Sunday 3rd of May, the Arbroath Accordion and Fiddle Club will welcome back Susan McFadgen as a guest artist for its meeting. Susan, a fine accordionist, will be joined on stage by her fiddle-playing sister, Shona. They have both taken part in competitions across Scotland, having been very successful on many occasions. Both well-established musicians, they have performed on BBC Scotland's Take the Floor and recently providing music and music tutoring at a major Scottish country dance festival in New Zealand. The doors of the Meadowbank Inn will open at 1 p.m. with the music starting at 1:30. And the club would welcome anyone to come along, newcomers especially welcome. Big item here now, RNLI rescue fishing boat drifting near wind farm. A volunteer crew from Montrose RNLI launched in the early hours of Friday 24th of April to assist a fishing vessel that had lost power around 21 nautical miles off the coast of Montrose. The all-weather lifeboat, RNLB Brian Adlington, a relief lifeboat currently on station in Montrose while RNLB Ian Grant Smith undergoes scheduled maintenance, was tasked at 3:10 a.m. by the Coast Guard. The volunteer crew launched within 12 minutes of the initial page, departing from Montrose Harbour at 3:22 a.m. As the lifeboat departed Montrose Harbour, visibility was severely reduced, with the crew unable to see Skurdy Ness Lighthouse or nearby navigational buoys. However, conditions improved about 5 nautical miles offshore with the weather clearing. On arrival at the scene, conditions were clear and calm. The casualty vessel had suffered engine failure and was drifting just 1 nautical mile from the Sea Green offshore wind farm. The cox assessed the situation and determined that undertaking a tow would be the safest and most efficient way to assist the casualty. A tow line was successfully established by 4:40 a.m. and a slow tow back to Montrose Harbour began. During the return journey, conditions changed again, and as the lifeboat approached Montrose, the crew encountered thick fog, requiring careful navigation back into the harbour. The vessel was brought safely into the port at around 8 a.m., where, with support from HM Coast Guard, the casualty vessel was safely secured in the harbour. The lifeboat was stood down about 8:10 a.m. Following the call, the volunteer crew carried out standard procedures to wash down, refuel, and prepare the lifeboat for service. What a marvellous story and what a great example of what volunteers do to help other people. There are two pages covered with information about the candidates for the upcoming Holyrood election, but I'm not going to read them to you. I think you'll pick that up on other news. I'm going to go to a bit of sport now as I'm moving through the paper, because there's an item on tennis in Montrose that I thought would be of interest to you, because it's obviously quite a thriving tennis club that they've got there. So, two tennis winners for Montrose. Two Montrose Tennis Club players won open tournaments last week, with Cameron Fryer winning the Scottish Indoor Doubles Championship in Glasgow and Scott Henderson winning the Scotland Tour event at the Aberdeen Tennis Centre. And there's pictures of these two young men actually in there preparing to play. Cameron and his partner Ewan McIntosh came out top in a strong field featuring numerous players who have or have had world rankings, beating Nicholas Rosengeitz and Neil Maskovic 6-4, 6-3 in the final. Their semi-final win was notable as they defeated former Pro Tour player John O'Mahony and his highly ranked partner, Ewan Lumsden, 10-7 in the deciding long tiebreak. The tournament victory is the latest in a string for the Montrose player, who is on the Stirling University team and is ranked 56th in Great Britain. In the Aberdeen tournament, Scott, who was the top seed, won all four of his matches, finishing strongly by beating Stuart Adams of Aberdeen, the second seed. Meanwhile, in the first week of tennis Tayside play, Montrose ladies fared better than the men, winning two of three matches. The men had a tough first week draw, with two matches against the resurgent St Andrews Tennis Club and were winless overall. So that's the end of my contribution. I hope you've enjoyed those snippets of news from today's paper, and I'm signing off. Bye-bye.
Welcome to my recording from Angus County Press, dated Thursday, 7th May 2026. It's Gwen McIntosh here, reading for you on a lovely Saturday morning, just one day after David Attenborough reached his 100th birthday. I'll start with the leading article, Overwhelmed by £4,500 total. Breachan family raises thousands in one day for charity, by Mark Dowie. A Breachan family who set out to raise funds for a charity which provided them with support since their daughter was diagnosed with a rare condition, secured £4,500 for the cause in just one day. Susan Tooke has been a keen supporter of Children's Liver Disease Foundation, now merged with the British Liver Trust, ever since daughter Fern, who is now 11, was seriously taken ill with portal hypertension several years ago. The condition is caused by high blood pressure in the portal vein that runs through the liver, and the six-year-old had to be flown to London for treatment. Since then, Fern and her family have been provided with continuing information and support by the charity, which aims to raise awareness of and fight the different types of liver disease which affect children. Susan said, "Fern is now keeping well and attends our local hospital in Dundee for regular checkups. However, childhood liver disease doesn't just disappear. I know that the British Liver Trust will be there for Fern as she grows up, and I want that to be the case for every young person affected." As a thank you, the family decided to join in Big Yellow Friday, the charity's annual fundraising day, which was held recently. Susan continued, "We'd originally planned a small coffee morning at home, but it quickly turned into more of an afternoon event at the Jars Community Hub in Breachan, which I felt would appeal to more people as we could catch them after work and the school run. The response from everyone was just wonderful. I had so many offers of help, as well as tea, coffee and cakes. We had a raffle, face painting, poetry reading and even a spiritual medium offering readings. We spread the word through Facebook, social media sharing, word of mouth and posters dotted around Breachan, which led to a great turnout. The fundraising was boosted by Fern's school, Maisondieu Primary School, which was already holding a charity day on the same date, with the proceeds of a jumble sale split between four charities. Susan said, "As a community, Breachan has always been very understanding of what we went through. Even so, the support we received on Big Yellow Friday was just fantastic. The final boost came from my husband Brian's workplace, TACA, whose corporate social responsibility program matches funds raised by employees for charities close to their heart. That brought our total to just over £4,500. We were completely overwhelmed, and Fern is absolutely ecstatic. To raise so much for a cause which means so much to us is just wonderful." Michelle Wilkins from the British Liver Trust praised the amazing total, said, "We've been supporting Fern and her family for several years now, so the fact that they were so keen to join in with Big Yellow Friday meant a lot to us, and this result is just amazing. It speaks volumes of the supportive school and community they have around. The money will benefit young people and families affected by liver disease around the UK, and Fern should feel very proud of herself." Laurie is top care nurse, and there's a lovely picture of Laurie Fisher, who was named Care Home Nurse of the Year. An Angus nurse has been named the best in the country after winning a national award from the Royal College of Nursing, the RCN. Laurie Fisher from Arbroath was named Care Home Nurse of the Year for the exceptional care she gives to her residents. Laurie Fisher, Service Quality Manager and Registered General Nurse, RGN, consistently makes a significant impact across her employer BCG's care homes. Having devoted her career to the care sector since the age of 16, Laurie's dedication and leadership have been widely recognised at a national level. Laurie's win marks the second time a BCG nurse has taken home the coveted prize in the last three awards. Given in recognition of excellence in Scottish nursing, the awards are regarded as a benchmark to celebrate the dedication, professionalism and outstanding care delivered by teams and individuals throughout the country. Laurie was one of three finalists in the category, shortlisted from hundreds of applicants, which spotlights those who have made an exceptional contribution to the well-being and quality of life of care home residents. Laurie was inspired to study nursing after joining BCG and has thrived within the profession, rising through a series of increasingly senior clinical and managerial positions. Latterly, she took on the wider organisational role of Operations Support Manager before stepping into her current position as Service Quality Manager, where she now influences standards across 24 homes. Laurie said, "Working in an underrepresented area of nursing comes with challenges, but it also brings purpose. I'm passionate about helping change perceptions and encouraging both newly qualified and experienced nurses to consider this truly rewarding profession. Most importantly, it's about ensuring they are recognised for how inspiring they are." Karen Johnson, BCG Managing Director, said, "We couldn't be prouder of Laurie for bringing home this important award. She really does give this job everything and is highly respected across every one of our homes. Laurie is a superb ambassador for every BCG nurse and for care home nurses across the country who deliver exceptional care every day." Here's an article by Mark Dowie called "Gardens Open by Arrangement." Two Scotland's Garden Scheme gardens in the Angus, Dundee and South Kincardineshire area will be opening by arrangement only this year. Visitors can have all the advantages of a private visit and book and go with friends or a group and make a day of it, as teas will be available. Orchard Cottage at Lunan Bay boasts an enviable situation on a quiet farm track near the sea. A cottage garden 20 years in the making, it incorporates lots of art and plenty of seating to catch the precious sun. The garden is divided into four main areas: lawned with wall and borders, a pond area with abundant planting and greenhouse, a productive area with raised beds, fruit cage and a converted aviary, and finally a shaded garden spot to look to Red Castle. It is about abundance and cultivated plants sitting side by side with wildflowers, giving colour and interest for as much of the year as possible. Carol is a devoted owner and gardener with lots of knowledge to share. A visit here is a delight. Anyone interested should contact her on 07485-609506. At 15 Fairfield Road in Broughty Ferry is a sunny contemporary garden with many mature trees and shrubs, plus lots of recently planted beds and borders. A shady courtyard contains Japanese acers and spring flowering bulbs, while colourful perennial planting near the house attracts pollinating insects. A new productive area with raised beds and a greenhouse is used to grow fruit and veg, plus dahlias and annual cut flowers. Anyone wishing to visit should email the owner, Aileen, at aileen@me.com. Now, Mark Dowie is writing about questions raised over cost of listed buildings. Angus councillors have considered the status of the county's listed buildings as a boost or a burden on the authority. Elected members recently approved a new historic property asset management plan, which ensures important sites are properly safeguarded. In total, there are more than 2,100 listed buildings in Angus, although the council has responsibility for just 76, including 9 which are A-listed. They are part of an overall council property portfolio valued at more than £675 million. The new strategy led some councillors to ask why some significant sites are not listed, including Carnoustie's award-winning War Memorial and the statues of Montrose sculptor William Lamb. It also brought a warning that many listed buildings are an asset rather than a liability. Historic Environment Scotland, HES, regulates listed buildings and the addition or removal from the list of more than 45,000 across the country. Owners face a variety of controls around what can be done to properties depending on their A, B or C grade listing. The 9 A-listed council properties represent more than 10% of the most precious buildings in Angus, including our Broad Signal Tower, Forfar Municipal Buildings, Montrose Library, Montrose Townhouse and our Broad Mortuary Chapel. Council official Ian Cochrane gave assurance that the assets are maintained to the best of the council's ability, which includes Carnoustie War Memorial. Elected members were told they could request a listing for any building by making an approach to HES. Workers' Day Ceremony. A moving ceremony was held in Forfar recently to mark International Workers' Memorial Day, bringing together Angus Council, trade union elected members, young people and the wider community. The occasion remembered those who have lost their lives due to work-related accidents and diseases. The ceremony included a tribute to George Ramsay of Unite the Union, who died recently and played a key role in establishing the annual IWMD commemoration in Angus. He was remembered for his dedication to representing union members and will be greatly missed. Held at the memorial bench and tree at Forfar Academy, the event included speeches, music from Angus School's music service, and a wreath-laying ceremony. Attendees gathered to honour those who have died because of work and to reaffirm the ongoing commitment to protecting workers and preventing future tragedies. Held annually since 1989, Workers' Memorial Day is an opportunity to highlight the preventable nature of most workplace incidents and ill health and to promote campaigns and union organisation in the fight for improvements in workplace safety. Focus on Rugby Trust's work. The speaker at the latest meeting of our Broad Rotary Club was Margaret Ann Laurie, daughter of member William Laurie. Margaret Ann, who holds a degree in Sport and Recreation Management, joined Strathmore Rugby Community Trust in 2019. She delivered a detailed and engaging presentation on the Trust, which itself was founded in 2017. Focusing on its work, supporting and inspiring people of all ages through the ethos of rugby, she gave details on 9 initiatives it delivers across the county, including wide-ranging projects such as Walking Rugby, Sporting Memories and the Autism Rugby. The Trust believes these improve participants' health, well-being and promote a sense of community and belonging. Max Wallace gave the vote of thanks. Royal Visit Recognises Ports Renewables Role by Mark Dowie. His Royal Highness the Duke of Edinburgh visited Montrose Port Authority, MPA, during his recent visit to the town in recognition of the port's significant decarbonisation achievement. The visit also marked the port's position as an integral operations and maintenance hub for offshore wind on the east coast of Scotland. The Duke was received by Angus Lord Lieutenant Patricia Sawyers, Provost Craig Fotheringham, Angus Council Chief Executive Catherine Lindsay and Port Chief Executive Tom Hutchison. Pupils from Ferryden School also welcomed the Duke, presenting a framed drawing and waving flags bearing the Earl of Forfar crest, a royal title also held by the Duke, specific to Angus. In the port's boardroom, the Duke met with port representatives, including board chairman Peter Stewart and chief commercial officer Lynn Sayer, alongside Martin Pibworth, chief executive of SSE PLC, and senior figures from SSE Renewables and Total Energy. The companies are two of the partners behind Seagreen Offshore Wind Farm, Scotland's largest operational fixed offshore wind project, for which the port functions as operations and maintenance O&M base. Also present was Maria Boss, chief executive of Plug, a leading Norwegian shore power company and joint venture partner behind Plug Montrose, the port's shore power facility. His Royal Highness viewed construction work underway on the port's second O&M base for the Inchcape offshore wind farm and visited Seagreen's existing O&M base and control room, where he heard about the logistics of running the facility. He also viewed the ongoing renovation of the historical B-listed customs house, which is being transformed into a commercial space for the renewables supply chain and a dedicated offshore wind skills academy. Mr. Hutchison said this visit was an important opportunity to demonstrate how we are supporting Scotland's energy transition while building a lasting legacy for our local community. From offshore wind operations and our shore power system to the development of the Skills Academy, our focus is on creating sustainable opportunities that will deliver long-term benefits for Angus. Guide Dogs Step Out in Historic Surroundings by Mark Dowie. Four guide dog puppies took to the grounds of historic Glamis Castle recently to enjoy a training session to mark International Guide Dog Day. The pups, Weston, Carter, Brave and Shan, were accompanied by their volunteer puppy raisers and guide dog staff for the outing, aimed at helping them prepare for life as working guide dogs. Puppy Development Supervisor Lorna Barclay said, "We took our puppy class into the grounds of Glamis Castle, exploring the garden. This offered our pups a chance to experience some new sights, sounds and textures underfoot. International Guide Dog Day recognises and celebrates the extraordinary contribution of these highly trained dogs, as well as the profound impact they have on the lives of their handlers. Beyond essential mobility support, guide dogs also offer companionship, confidence, and emotional reassurance. The use of guide dogs dates back to the 16th century. In recognition of centuries of service and partnership, International Guide Dog Day is observed each year on the last Wednesday of April. The date is significant as it marks the foundation of the establishment of the International Federation of Guide Dog Associations on April 26, 1989. Lorna added, "The pups had a great time exploring and did really well all walking together. We would like to thank the team at Glamis Castle for welcoming us. It really does make all the difference to help us turn pups into life-changing guide dog partnerships, and we look forward to more visits in the future." Puppy raisers care for a guide dog puppy for around 12 to 18 months. The volunteers provide a vital foundation for the pup's future role as a guide dog through training, socialization, and the introduction of new environments and experiences, and Guide Dogs is currently on the lookout for more. Lorna added, "We do need more volunteers in the area and encourage people to get in touch. With your support, we can help train more life-changing guide dogs for people with sight loss. The charity pays for essential costs, including food and bills. To find out more about becoming a puppy raiser for guide dogs, visit www.guide-dogs.org.uk/puppyraiser. Call for efficient use of water supply. Scottish Water is asking customers across the country to take measures now to enable them to use water more efficiently ahead of any extended period of dry weather that might impact supplies through the year. Customers are being called upon to follow important advice on water consumption by taking shorter showers, only using a full load in the washing machine, installing a water butt in your garden. A small household roof collects over 45,000 litres of water each year, and a large roof can collect over 90,000 litres per year, which is plenty to help your garden grow when the weather is dry. Using a watering can in the garden rather than a hose where possible, a hose uses 1,000 litres of water an hour. Sponge washing your car. A hose pipe can use enough water in 30 minutes to fill 5 bathtubs. Only boiling the water you need for your cup of tea or coffee. Turning the tap off when brushing teeth. Cleaning teeth with the tap running wastes 5 litres of water a minute. A dripping tap can waste over 5,500 litres of water a year, so make sure taps are turned off properly or replace the washer. Using dishwashers only when full. Some football here for you now. Rose Lee get knocked out. Montrose Rose Lee exited the Thorntons Cup after losing 3-1 to Carnoustie Panmure at Gill Park in the second round. It would be a stern test for Rose Lee, as Carnoustie, who had Rio Bradford facing his old side, are a mid-table Premiership side. Carnoustie came out of the traps quickly, and after 6 minutes, a through ball split the home defence, allowing Christie to open the scoring with a neat finish. The hosts tried to hit back as Duff headed straight into the keeper's arms, while Emsley's running power was on show. The equaliser arrived after 31 minutes, when Calder was through one-on-one with Panmure's keeper, only to be pulled back in the box. This resulted in a straight red card Buchanan, and Murray Smith stepped up to send the keeper the wrong way from 12 yards. On the stroke of half-time, Panmure restored their lead when Davis Brown cut inside unchallenged and unleashed a powerful strike into the bottom corner. Rosalie started the second half positively, but the visitors doubled their advantage on 51 minutes through Dibemba. To add insult to injury, Rosalie had McDonald go off with a shoulder injury while Emsley pulled up with a hamstring problem. Forfar rounded off their League Two campaign on Saturday with a 1-1 draw away to Annan. They were back in action on Tuesday night as they lost 3-1 to Hamilton Academical in the first leg of the playoff semi-final. Kyle McDonald gave the visitors the lead a minute before the break, with Ollie Shaw adding a brace in the second half. Scott Shepherd pulled one back in the injury time at the end of the game to just about keep the tie alive. The second leg was due to take place the following Saturday as Forfar make the trip to Broadwood Stadium.
Hello, my name is Lindsay. The definition of password can mean either a secret word to gain admission to a place or a string of characters keyed into an electronic device like a computer to access a network. World Password Day relates to the latter and falls on the first Thursday of May, this year the 7th of May. This day came about in a less than efficient way, considering it related to logical security steps in a digital age. Security researcher Mark Burnett had started the idea with a book called Perfect Passwords, suggesting in 2005 that everyone should have their own password days, whereby they update and change their current ones. Later, the American multinational technology corporation Intel, known for their central processing microchip units for over 50 years, took up the mantle and created a worldwide observance in 2013. Their aim, to communicate and educate people about creating strong passwords and the importance of regularly updating them to remain information secure online. In fact, it was the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, MIT, in 1961, which established computer password coding, allowing multiple people to use a shared computer system. Yet by 1978, a study published that guessing passwords through knowing certain personal information, like a pet's name, was easier than deciphering the authentication codes. Since 2020, there has been many electronic data breaches, prompting another worldwide survey, citing the top two electronic passwords commonly used and taking less than 1 second to crack by criminals were the number sequence 123456, used by 3.5 million, and the actual noun, password, used by 1.7 million people. Talking of fail-safe codes, it was during World War II that huge breakthroughs in both transmitting and decoding secret messages took place. Various nations turned to their indigenous languages for communicating through enemy-occupied territory. The United States military employed 400 to 500 Native American code talkers to operate radios transmitting highly sensitive tactical information between officers and frontline posts, mostly in languages of Navajo, Comanche, and Hopi. It proved successful because the enemy troops could not decipher either their tribal alphabet letters and numbers, nor the made-up terminology systems. For example, in Navajo, there is no word for submarine, so they dubbed them iron fish. The British Army, too, had a bash at using the native Welsh language, though not to any great extent, and soon found it cumbersome to continue. During the same war, though only civilians, the Channel Islanders switched from their usual English and French to draw on their native Je'e language when informing each other of invaders' activities and passing vital information to British forces while under enemy occupation. Bletchley Park, Milton Keynes, Buckinghamshire, also became a place of surprising ingenuity in 1939. People from all occupations in Britain were recruited for their intelligence and linguistic abilities. They began with just 200 staff, then by 1944, a significant jump to 9,000, all joining the British government Station X Code and Cipher School. To help the war effort, they deciphered enemy transmissions, proving an advantage to the British military, either by preempting battles or interfering with enemy communicated plans. This work, headed by Alan Turing, British mathematician, computer scientist, logician and cryptanalyst, paved the way for building the first domestic computer, an essential in modern day life. As a point of interest, Bletchley Park is now a museum open daily, offering audio description electronically for two exhibitions: multimedia, large print, tactile and braille guides, and is guide dog friendly. Of course, those with visual impairment do face unique challenges utilising electronic technology because of creating, entering and managing passwords. Codes, which are reliant on conventional systems providing visual prompts. Coping with these is done by combining assistive technologies, accessible software and tactile methods along with secure strategies. Screen readers, like JAWS, NVDA and VoiceOver are converters of text to speech or braille. Although less than 1% of UK visually impaired people can read braille, so most will need headphones for privacy when listening to spoken text in public places. Password management tools such as 1Password or Bitwarden can be helpful, as some companies like Apple, with their iCloud keychain, build in unique password security systems. Increasingly popular for everyone are biometrics, which only require touchscreen devices to accept individuals' fingerprints or face recognition, unlocking networks. Though to add another layer of security for particularly sensitive information, besides passwords and PIN digits, are the two-factor authentication, 2FA services, which often link with a one-off code via phone text or email account entered after users' passwords. The Royal National Institute for the Blind People, RNIB, also have assistive technology for computers too. Whether speaking secret codes or entering digital passwords, security is best served by keeping track of individual preferences and systems. May you secure some time to review and update key details.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Amanda, with a short story written especially for Talking Newspaper listeners by author Chris Crowther. Chris spent many years as a pilot. Then, after his retirement from flying, he spent 5 years as a skipper on passenger boats in the Norfolk Broads. Chris has published 9 full-length novels about ex-Scotland Yard detective Jack Fellows, who now patrols as a river ranger, assisting boaters and enforcing bylaws while using his old police instincts to suss trouble. This short story, featuring a visually impaired main character, has been written especially for TNF Soundings to share with Talking Newspaper listeners. This story is titled Beyond the Call. Considering the significance military service would play in the events to come, it was perhaps appropriate that Jack should first meet Cathy Winton below the remains of the old Roman fort at Birr Castle. Half a mile back, he'd entered the Waveney, his favourite southern river, flowing down to Olton, Broad and Beccles. Passing the old fort, he pondered how, 17 centuries before, it had guarded the estuary against increasing Saxon raids. Now all that remained were 3 flint walls, and the only invaders, the numerous leisure craft that, in this busy holiday period, were already churning the river's surface. Alongside the castle moorings on this warm, sunny day were 3 such boats, a medium-sized motor cruiser and 2 traditional wooden sailing yachts named Sunburst and Sundog. On the latter, some lads in their early teens were busy washing decks, while in the cockpit of the other, 4 girls of the same age were seated with 2 young women. In the summer months, various youth organisations hired sailing cruisers, like these, for a week's adventure afloat, and Jack was sure this small flotilla was one such group. Mooring up, he made his way to Sunburst, where the slightly older of the 2 adults was teaching rope work to the girl crew. "Okay," she encouraged. "Now you've learnt the bowline, try and do one with your eyes closed." As the youngsters set about their challenge, Jack took the opportunity to introduce himself as the River Ranger.
"How's the holiday going?"
The woman looked up through wraparound sunglasses and smiled. "Oh, wonderful, thanks. Come and join us." She held out her hand. "I'm Cathy Winton." She nodded towards the other young woman in the cockpit. "And this is Gemma, my sighted first mate."
"Good to meet you," said Jack, "and to see you teaching some of the old skills."
Cathy shrugged. "That's what our group's all about, showing youngsters that there's no limit to what they can do." She removed her sunglasses, whatever their personal circumstances. Now Jack understood Cathy's use of the word sighted, for he could see that this young woman's eyes were sightless and surrounded by a veritable web of healed scar tissue.
"Well, they couldn't wish for better inspiration, Cathy."
"We try," she said, popping her shades back on and indicating the 2 adults on Sundog moored just ahead. "Jim, the lad's leader, has a prosthetic leg, and Henry, his mate, took part in the last Paralympics."
"A great team indeed."
Jack nodded to the motor cruiser moored ahead of them.
"How about that boat? Is it part of your group?"
"Oh, you mean Vixen?" Cathy's tone hardened slightly.
No, that belongs to an elderly ex-major called Bertie Barraclough, who somehow latched onto us, always wanting to help and very keen to relate all his war stories to the children. In the corner of the cockpit, Gemma smiled. I think he's just lonely, really, and the youngsters are always keen to hear what he has to say. But he's an unwanted distraction and keeps following us around, complained Kathy, before cocking an ear towards Vixen. Actually, Jack, I can hear his hatch opening, so you'll be able to judge for yourself. Kathy's sharp hearing was proved correct, as a broad-shouldered, slightly stocky man in his mid-60s emerged from the cruiser, pausing only to smooth his military-looking moustache before heading straight for Sundog.
Morning, lads. Lovely day.
Major Barraclough's booming voice had probably served him well in the army. Oh, morning, Major. The four boys needed little encouragement to cease their mopping and chat. Yes, looks like another hot one.
But not as hot as some of the places I served,
bellowed the Major.
I remember back in Aden, like an oven, and me and my platoon fighting our way out of a dead-end wad. Got me the DSC, though, so...
But he got no further before Leader Jim intervened. A fascinating tale, I'm sure, Major, but we're off upriver soon, so these boys need to get this boat cleaned and ship-shape.
Oh, right,
grunted the old soldier regretfully, before shuffling off to leave the lads begrudgingly resuming their cleaning. See what I mean? Said Kathy. Jack stroked his chin.
He does seem keen to reminisce, but surely service to your country isn't a bad thing for youngsters to hear about.
I agree, Jack, but only if it's true, because some of Barraclough's tales go way beyond the realms of probability. Like him telling the boys just now that he'd won the DSC in Aden. That surely can't be true, seeing as the Distinguished Service Cross is purely a naval decoration.
Good point, Gaffy,
agreed Jack.
But you seem to know a lot about the military yourself.
That's because I was in Afghanistan as a medic. She tapped her sunglasses. Which is how I ended up like this.
You mean you lost your sight serving your country?
Kathy nodded. By stepping on an AED when I was running to help a wounded soldier.
Probably through being too dedicated,
admired Jack.
But rotten luck on you.
She shrugged. I did at least survive, but having experienced active service makes me very suspicious of heroic tales like Barraclough's.
Okay,
conceded Jack.
But he's not the first veteran to embroider his war service.
But Kathy was in no mood for moderation. Perhaps not, but he just won't leave us alone, and he's beginning to undermine our authority. Surely that can't be right.
Not when youngsters are involved,
agreed Jack.
So let me check things out. Give me your mobile number and I'll get back to you.
Jack nodded towards Barraclough, just climbing back aboard Vixen.
Perhaps by then, Major Bertie will have found someone else to bore.
If only, grinned Kathy back. Jack was thankful for next afternoon's enduring sunshine as the Waveney carried his patrol launch upriver between the riverside dwellings and boatyards of St. Olaf's. True to his promise, he'd called his old contact at Scotland Yard and requested any information they had on Major Bertie Barraclough. Having received a reply that same evening, he then called Kathy, been told the flotilla was night-stopping at St. Olaf's, and arranged to rendezvous there the next day. And so here he was, with the tall masts of the sailboats easy to spot, amongst several other hire craft, moored beside a working boatyard. He looked for Vixen and spotted the cruiser lying several boats away, with Barraclough sitting on his cabin roof, droning on to a young couple standing patiently listening on the quay below. On the sailboats,
Only Kathy could be seen, busying herself in Sunburst's cockpit. Jack swung his launch into the tide and was soon alongside.
"Good to see you again," greeted Kathy, smiling as she made fast the launch's lines. "Come aboard."
"What happened to the others?"
asked Jack, once he'd joined her in Sunburst's cockpit.
"Off exploring the village's old Augustinian priory, leaving me to brush up on my splicing."
She picked up a length of 3-strand rope with an eye splice worked into one end.
"My next lesson for the girls."
"All good stuff."
Jack glanced 200 yards down the quay to where Vixen lay moored adjacent to the boatyard's open work area. Here several boats were laid up ashore, supported by wooden props and chocks, and providing tempting hidey-holes for a little girl and 2 small boys, happily playing hide-and-seek in between them. Jack guessed them to be the offspring of the couple still being lectured by the voluble Barraclough. He turned back to Kathy.
"I see our Major Bertie has found a new audience for his tales."
"Yes, poor them," agreed Kathy with a little chuckle. He arrived too late yesterday to moor next to us and had to settle for that slot further down."
She paused and frowned.
"But you said your inquiries had produced results, Jack. Anything we should know?"
"I think so. The fact is that..."
But Jack was suddenly stopped mid-sentence by a piercing scream from further down the quay. It came from the yard's laid-up boats, one of which was now heeled over at a perilous angle, as 2 small boys scrambled from beneath. That left the little girl, probably still there, and somehow trapped. Jack grabbed Kathy by the shoulder.
"There's been an accident. Come on, we may need your medical skills."
Helping her ashore, they both ran down the quay, Kathy holding Jack's shoulder for guidance. Fast as they ran, however, Jack could see that they had been beaten to the scene by no other than Bertie Barraclough. While the young parents stood frozen with shock, he had leapt from atop his cabin and sprinted straight to the listing boat, with its one remaining support already splintering under the strain. Without hesitation, Bertie dived headlong beneath to wedge his broad shoulders under the turn of its bilge, adding not only support, but even raising the boat just enough for the little girl to free herself.
"Get out!"
yelled Bertie, as the remaining prop creaked and splintered some more. The girl scuttled free, but even as she did, there came an even more ominous crack from the remaining prop, as it gave way completely and the boat rolled onto its beam ends with a force beyond even Bertie's strength. Arriving at the scene, Jack and Kathy were met with only a cloud of dust and the old soldier's agonized groans from beneath. Other witnesses dashed to the scene, but Jack held them back.
"You ladies get the children away from here and one of you call an ambulance. Now! You men help me raise this boat."
It was wood-built and heavy, but with 6 of them heaving, they managed just a momentary lift while others pushed in temporary chocks. Precarious as that was, Kathy felt her way beneath and began examining the stricken Bertie.
"One leg is badly crushed," she called back. "Get me something I can roll him onto so you can pull him out."
Some old carpet was swiftly produced, and a groaning Bertie was carefully pulled free. An exhausted Kathy knelt beside him, offering what comfort she could, until the urgent wail of an ambulance meant his pain would soon be eased, at least a little.
"So how did it happen?"
Jim, back from the group's run ashore and anxious to hear Jack and Kathy's explanation of the drama enacted just a half hour before, had quickly joined them in Sunburst's cockpit.
"A pure accident," explained Jack. "Apparently one of the children dislodged a prop and over the boat went."
"Trapping a little girl who's only alive now, thanks to Bertie's brave action," added Kathy.
"But leaving him injured," frowned Jim,
whose concern was only amplified by the ambulance's siren as it sped out of the yard. How badly? Cathy looked crestfallen. He'll probably survive, but that leg is badly crushed, and he'll be lucky to keep it.
Amputation? It was clear Jim was recalling his own past trauma. Well, if it comes to that, I'll be only too glad to give all the help and support I can. It's the least I can do for a hero like Bertie.
He glanced towards Sundog and all the youngsters gathered on board, looking sad.
They're pretty cut up, so I'd better get back and reassure them.
As Jim hurried off, two other figures appeared beside Sunburst. It was the little girl Bertie had rescued, together with her mum. Both still looked badly shaken, but they had come over to thank Cathy for all she did. The mother glanced in the direction of the ambulance's siren, its wail growing ever distant as it sped on its urgent way.
"That poor man! We owe Lucy's life to him."
She gave her daughter a thankful squeeze.
"He was such a hero. Just a minute before he'd been recalling his own brave adventures and then, without a moment's thought, risked his life again to save Lucy."
After words of comfort, they left to return to their boat while Cathy turned back to Jack.
"And to think, I've done nothing these last few days but badmouth poor Bertie."
Jack laid a comforting hand on her shoulder.
"That was just between you and me, Cathy, and nothing to feel guilty about. Having, I suspect, been decorated yourself for bravery, it must have upset you knowing his stories weren't true. You were just voicing concern for the youngsters in your care."
"Perhaps."
She shook away regretful thoughts.
"But before the accident, you were about to tell me what you'd found out about his past."
"If you still want to hear it."
She shrugged. "If it helps ease my conscience, Jack, then go ahead."
"Okay, well, records show that Bertie Barraclough did indeed serve in the army, though not with the distinction he would have everyone believe. For a start, it wasn't as an officer, but as a lowly squaddy, and even that ended in May 1982.
Cathy mulled over that date.
"Wasn't that the start of the Falklands War?"
Jack nodded.
"Yep, and Bertie's unit were the first to be deployed. But he wasn't with them, because he did a bunk the night before embarkation."
"He deserted?"
gasped Cathy.
"To avoid active service?"
"Seems that way,"
confirmed Jack.
"After arrest, he was court-martialed and did a spell in detention before receiving a dishonourable discharge."
Cathy went quiet, and Jack could imagine her thinking of the little girl so narrowly clutched from tragedy. Then she finally said, with a smile,
"But Jack, what you've just told me, that surely can't be our Major Bertie."
Jack glanced down quay to where the little family sat subdued, but safe. Perhaps the past was where some things were best left.
"No, you're absolutely right, Cathy. It couldn't possibly be our Bertie."
TNF Soundings.